So we're in John chapter 13. I'm just going to jump right in. Verse 1. Now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come, that he should depart from this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. So this chapter, chapter 13, is on the night of Jesus' betrayal and his death. So John is going to take, I think, 5 chapters to talk about this night. And any of you guys who have lost someone that's really close to you, you know that usually it kind of sticks in your brain. It really singes into your memory the last moments that you got to spend with that person. And that's what's happening with John. John will always remember this night because this was the night that he watched his most loved person in his life die. John actually had to witness him die. So he gives us more detail about this final night than any other gospel writer, which is really interesting. And so this chapter really is about, it's really interesting because he's been hinting at it the whole time, because John is the love dude, you know, and 1 John is all about love. If you ever want to read a good book about love, 1 John is a good book to go to. He's just like the love guy. And he's been kind of hinting around this whole concept of love his whole book. But this is going to be the chapter he's really going to dive into it. And that's why he says, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. That's what this chapter is about. It's about Jesus' love and how it changes us. And before we get into John's description of love and his description of Christ, I think it's important to remember that when we're reading this book, John's whole purpose of writing this book is he's trying to show that Jesus is the best way to get every need that a human being has. So he's talking about our spiritual needs this whole book. He's talked about things like our sense of value. Human beings need to have a sense of value and identity, and John has said Jesus is the best place to go for that. Human beings need to have a feeling of affirmation because we feel guilty and we feel like we haven't been living up to standards. So Jesus is the best way to give us affirmation. Jesus is the best way to give us our forgiveness. He's the best way. Everything he's trying to show that Jesus is the best. And in this chapter, what he's going to show is that Jesus is the best person to love you. Right? Love is probably the quintessential human need. It is something that every single person on this earth absolutely needs. It's something you cannot live without. For a while, in America at least, there was an ideal that was happening in some areas of the country that they thought love is necessary, but you could love like material things and be okay. That's the whole Mad Men kind of era, you know. And they're just like, hey, if you get rich and you have enough material things, that will get you through your life. But recently in America, we realized that that's not true, and you can't do it. You need to have a relational love, right? I could love music. I could love money. I could love all these other types of things, my hobbies, but those don't replace my need for a love that I have between another human being. I absolutely need to love somebody. And the reason why we crave this kind of love, why we crave this particular thing, is because love, if you think about it, it really is what gives you your greatest sense of who you are, and it's really where you get your greatest sense of value. In a loving relationship, that's where you get those things. In America, I know we're all individualistic and we'd like to believe that, man, no, I could just affirm myself. I could just tell myself I'm awesome. You can't do it, right? You know, you could try, but you do need someone to be there with you and to love you and to care for you and for you to love and care for them. If you think about it, love is the greatest motivator that we have as human beings. Nothing will motivate us more passionately, more strongly than love. Some people think it's fear, but that's just not true. Fear is a good motivator, but it's not a great motivator. If you think about it, you know, if fear was a really awesome motivator, then jail would actually be a good deterrent from keeping people from committing crimes. But it's not. And it's not because jail doesn't freak people out. It's just because fear is not a good enough motivator. It just isn't. When I was struggling with my sins, and I still struggle with them, I'll tell you, being afraid of my sin and the consequences of my sin was never strong enough to get me to stop. It just isn't. It's just not strong enough. The Bible contends, and I think that humanity is starting to figure out that it is true, love is the only thing strong enough to actually set you free, to actually get you on a new course. It is the greatest motivator, and it is the greatest source of, like I said, value, affirmation, and identity. So we absolutely do need love inside of our lives. Now, the problem that humanity has is that we simplify love, and we make love really, really simplistic. And here, there's two real categories of thought. There's a category of thought, and that's more in the Eastern cultures, that believe love is just about commitment. You just commit to someone. And if you think about it, it makes sense, right? What kind of marriages do they have in that part of the world? Arranged marriages, right? If love was an emotional kind of thing, then all their marriages would fail. So what they say is marriage is just love, marriage, everything like that. It's just about procreating, and it's just about taking care of your community. It's not about an emotion. It's about duty, loyalty, honor, respect. That's what love is. Our culture doesn't really think that way, right? You know, but our culture is more on the emotional side, right? We're like, yeah, you know, duty, honor, respect, loyalty, those are kind of important. But love is more about passion, right? It's more about an emotion that you need to have. And no matter which way you break, you get a big hole in your life. And we're going to be talking about that in a little bit. There's this woman named Esther Perel who gives these great TED Talks. She uses the word orgasm just a little bit too much, so I wouldn't recommend them to you guys. But I will say that her talks are just fantastic. She's so insightful on a lot of things. And she gives this one talk about the idea of love and passion and why they're seemingly contradictory. And this is what she says. This is why she says that love and desire, that's where we get passion from, are seemingly contradictory. She talks about marriage, and she says, when we're talking about the person that we want to marry, the person that we want to love the most, should I say, it doesn't necessarily have to be a spouse, could be a child, could be your parents, could be a friend. But she says, when we're dealing with someone like that, we say to them, give me belonging, give me identity, give me continuity, but give me transcendence and mystery and awe all in one. Give me comfort, give me edge, give me novelty, give me familiarity, give me predictability, yet give me surprise. And when and we think it's a given, oh, I can't read that sentence, it's actually kind of dirty. But anyway, what she's saying is like that there's this idea that, do you see how they're kind of contradictory? She says in desire, the desire part of us, the one that wants passion, right? That fire that's in love, we want surprise, right? But then the part of us that craves that loyalty says, no, I want predictability from you. I want to know that you're going to be there for me. Right? And you see how they're kind of contradictory? This is another way that she puts it. She says, if there's a verb for me that comes with love, it's to have. And if there is a verb that comes with desire, it's to want. In love, we want to have. We want to know the beloved. You see what her point is? Her point is that when you love someone, when you get into a marriage with someone, it so often kills passion because the passion came from the desire, from the mystery. You see? That's why so many couples, when they actually do get married, they actually do lose a lot of their passion because they realize that so much of their passion came from their desire, the intangibility. The wrongness of a relationship sometimes can bring about a whole lot of passion and desire inside of us. And just think about inside of your life, the things that we tend to be most passionate about are tend to be, more often than not, things that we know are wrong or things that we know are wrong for us. You know, some of the greatest memories that I have locked inside of my mind are the times where I did something that I knew was wrong, right? And I remember how it felt, like that rush, the adrenaline. You're just like, man, this is crazy. This is awesome. You know, it's wrong. I shouldn't do it. And it makes you feel kind of good. It brings about a whole lot of passion, right? And so what she's saying that the reason why cultures tend to split love like that, where it's either passion or it's loyalty, is because they're seemingly contradictory. She can't see, and in fact, if you listen to her whole talk, she can't reconcile how the two could ever come together. And let me explain to you guys why that's bad. All right, so if we're on the loyalty side, okay, I want loyalty, love becomes like a business enterprise. In fact, I think pretty much everyone in this room can understand why you wouldn't want love to be just about loyalty and about respect and honor and all that stuff, right? Sounds lame, doesn't it? Like, man, that's like, sounds like a job, you know? Like, I respect my job, I respect my boss, you know, I have loyalty to this place. That's what it is. And to make a marriage that way sounds so droll, you know? It sounds so lame. I don't want that. And that's, for me, by the way, this is a little caveat. When I was growing up in the church, this is why one of the motivations I had for leaving the church, for becoming an atheist, was this issue. Because I thought that the church viewed love as like a, you know, you kind of got to do it. You know, love God and, you know, love your neighbor as yourself. And it was kind of like this obligation, kind of like dry, passionless kind of thing. And I was like, that sounds really lame. But then I would watch like pornography and I would, you know, look at my friends. I'd be like, man, like their relationship seems super passionate. That seems awesome. You know, so it attracted me. Does that make sense? It attracted me away from the church because I thought the church was preaching a passionless type of love. Now, here's the problem with having a strictly passionate relationship, though. One of the reasons why passion isn't enough is, first of all, passion is finite. It doesn't matter how good a relationship is, passion will fade over time. Right? Any of us who have been in any relationship in our lives knows that's true. Right? Once you get into a relationship, it's very passionate. Over time, the passion seems to fade. And what we're illustrating in that moment is we're illustrating exactly what Esther Perel is saying. She's saying once you actually, the closer you get to someone, the more that mystery evaporates and the more the passion goes with it. The more that desirability starts to fade. And that's why it starts to go away. So first of all, passion is it's kind of finite. And the way that we get passion to really click inside of our relationships is we try to keep that mystery alive. We try to do things to try to jumpstart our passion. And it ends up becoming very foolish in a lot of ways. We try to force ourselves to be passionate when we stop feeling it. And when we stop feeling enough passion, we just jump ship. We go to another relationship. So because of that, because of passion, what happens is what develops, and this is what I've seen, what I've witnessed inside of my life, the couples that I know that survive only on passion have a lot of drama, their fights are incredibly explosive, and they tend to have a lot of envy, jealousy, and insecurity embedded in them. And if you think about it, it makes sense. Right? If the relationship's all about passion, if you don't have that fiery passion at all times, you might start to doubt, well, maybe I don't even love this person. Maybe my feelings for them aren't real. You know, maybe there's someone else out there for me. And if you're in a relationship with someone like that, you have to become jealous and envious all the time because the thought becomes, is like, do they really actually love me? Is this thing going to last? How much of myself do I want to give to this person before they abandon me like everybody else in my life? How vulnerable do I really want to be in front of this person before they leave me? How much of myself do I want to give to this person before they leave me? So it builds that insecurity, and so the passion inevitably kind of dies away as well. So you can't just have one without the other. But like I said, the problem that we have as humanity is it seems like it really is one or the other. And so because of that, love becomes this really struggling thing that we have as human beings. It doesn't make sense. Now, for the next couple of little bit, I want to read you guys the Hebrew view of love because I thought this was fascinating. I just studied this yesterday. The Hebrews had a view of love that is illustrated inside their language. Americans, actually, we have a very low, like I said, simplistic view of love, and it's demonstrated in our language. How many words do we have for love? One. We have one word for love. We have one of the most simplistic views of love of any language that's ever existed in human history. It's pretty sad. The Hebrews had over 12 words for love. They had over 12. I just picked out my favorites because some of them become redundant, but they basically mean the same thing. But let me just illustrate to you guys the Hebrew view of love because the reason why the Hebrews had this view of love is because they knew the true living God. This is where that view came from. It came from studying the nature of God. And listen to all the intricacies of their view of love. The first word that I'm going to give you is ahav. It's the generic word for love. It's almost like our word for love. But you'll see that they use the word ahav to actually describe these other words, meaning ahav encompasses all these other words. So let me start reading them to you guys. The first one's daud. Daud is passionate love, and it's a word that was used to describe something boiling over. You guys get the picture in your head? Like you got a pot on the stove or whatever, and it's boiling over because you walked out for 20 minutes or whatever, and it's just making a mess, right? That's the type of passion. It's boiling over with passion. And in fact, they would use the word doubt as a pet name. So if you were really in love with someone, you would call them your doubt. Like, man, you're my doubt. And what that means is you're the person that makes my heart beat. You know, you're the person that brings fire to my life. It's kind of cool, right? Now, the next word that they use is it looks like chabad, but I mean, that's probably a super white way to say it. It's probably like chabab or something like that. But anyway, this word means to cherish, but the more proper usage of the word is to hide in your chest or in your chest. So it's the idea of not only I'm passionate about you, But it's the idea of I cherish you to the point that I'm protective of you. Does that make sense? I treasure you so much that no one would hurt you. Nobody would ever harm you. I would protect you no matter what. So it's a protective kind of love. Isn't that cool? Now the next one is this. It's chesak or chesak. I don't know. It's the word to be joined to. So they would use it sometimes if you, you know, I don't know if you guys played with Legos or Kinect or something like that, but that's like the word you would use. They're chesak, you know, they're joined together. They're one. And it's the word that you would use. You wouldn't use it for like a work acquaintance or, you know, somebody that you met on Facebook. You would use that word only to describe the type of relationship. And once again, all these words could be utilized for any type of relationship, friendship, parental love, or romantic love. Now, this word, hasak, is kind of interesting because you would only use this word in relation to somebody that you are intimately involved with. So you could use it for a friend. You could say, if it was like a best friend, though. Like, man, we're like one. We're like one soul, man. Like, we just love each other, man. Nothing would break apart this bond. Or you'd use it, once again, for a spouse, or you'd use it for, like, your parents or something like that. The next one is racham, which means to show mercy, which is kind of interesting. So it's the idea that love is so passionate, so abundant, that you're able to love a person in their faults and forgive them no matter what. Does that make sense? So it's a love that's so passionate, so intimate, that no matter what fault you see in the other person, you immediately forgive it because you love them so much. Okay. The next one is Rea, and it's a friendship type of love. And what it refers to, and like I said, all these words are utilized for every type of relationship. What it means is it's like a buddy, a companion, someone that you have like interests with. And it's really interesting in the book Song of Solomon, they use that word Rea often to describe one another. What they're saying when they use that word is they're saying, not only do we have this passionate, intimate, amazing love, but we're also best friends. We can have fun together. We just like to hang out, right? You know, you could see in every relationship it's kind of like that, right? You know, if I have, you know, my dad, you know, we can have a great love between father and son, but it's way different if we have a father and son love as well as a friendship type of love where we could just hang out and have a good time. Does that make sense? You know, you could have a passionate relationship with a, you know, romantic relationship, but if you guys can't just hang out and have fun, that's kind of a sucky relationship, you know? It's like, what are you going to do? Just make out all the time and have sex? You know, it's kind of, eventually it's going to get old, you know? There's got to be more depth to it, is what I'm saying. There's got to be like a companionship type of deal going on. And so in the Hebrew way of thinking, isn't that crazy? In the Hebrew way of thinking, it wasn't love unless it incorporated all of them. Isn't that cool? So they had this like view of love. Now, when I read those to you guys, when I read them yesterday, what I realized is this is the best definition of love. And what I mean by that is if love actually looked like this, I would always want to have it. Now, what's the problem, though? Love doesn't look like this, right? Love doesn't look like this, and that's what breaks our hearts. We want desperately for love to look like this, but it doesn't look like this. And so that kind of sucks for us, right? And so, like I said, what we usually do as human beings is we just compartmentalize love. We say, well, okay, I can't have it all, so I just want this one part. I want the loyalty part, or I want the passion part. But I know I can't have all of them together. Now, the Bible, what the Bible is telling us, what Jesus is going to show us in this section, is you absolutely can have all of them. You absolutely can have all of them, but they're found in Christ. They're found in Jesus is the only way to do it. And as we go through this story, I'm going to show you why it can only be found in Jesus. Let's go to verse 2. Supper being ended, the devil having already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given him all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going to God, arose from supper and laid aside his garments, took a towel, and girded himself. Now, this is a crazy act that Jesus is doing. It's absolutely insane. What he's doing is in the household, there was, you know, if you were rich, you would have a lot of different servants. The lowest of the low washed the feet. And if you think about it for a second, it makes sense, right? It's kind of like any of you guys who've gotten a job, you know, when you first get a job, they give you the crap work. Like, man, someone's got to plunge the toilet. Get the new guy. You know, you got to do the crap. You got to do the worst work because you're the new guy. You know, in the Marine Corps, there was so much work that you can do. as a new person. On my deployment, some of the grossest things that I did was I had to unload. We had to poop in bags. I had to unload the poopy bags and burn them. And that was like, that was one of the most disgusting jobs I've ever done in my entire life. You know, you wouldn't do that to someone who's like, you know, I mean, imagine if like the president came to our little camp. We're like, hey, you know, you want to help us out? We got these poop bags. You know, would you like to burn them for us? And could you imagine Obama being like, oh yeah, poop bags? You know, like, yeah, dude, I'd love you guys. Let's do it. You know, like, no. Yeah, everywhere. No, like, no way that would ever happen, right? Now, here's the thing. Jesus, who claims to be our Lord, our Savior, our King, our God, is, in this moment, he is taking the worst, lowest, most humiliating role that you could possibly take, and he's washing people's feet. And it actually tells us how he was able to do this. It's verse 3. I'm going to read it again. Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and he had come from God and was going to God, arose from supper and laid aside his garments. How did Jesus do it? The reason why this is so important inside of a love relationship is because something that tends to be missing from a lot of love relationships, something that we all struggle with, is whenever I come into a love relationship, whether it's with my parents, whether it's with a friend, whether it's with my wife, I bring a lot of my ego into it, and I bring a lot of my selfishness into it. I have to. In fact, if you think about it, like I said, love is a need that every human being has. It's not just a want, it's a need. So because of that, when I go to another person, what I'm doing is I'm going to someone empty. I'm going to someone empty, and I'm looking to be filled. And let's be honest. When we go to relationships inside of our lives, what are we looking for? We're looking for something, right? We're looking to receive something. We're not looking to give, we're looking to receive. And so because that selfishness is already ingrained in us from day one when we go into the relationship, we're always going to be looking to take from the relationship, and we're not going to be seeking to give. In fact, in relationships, I mean, think about it, just in your own minds. Think about all the relationships that you have inside of your life. Even the good things that you do are because you want something in return. Right? You may do something nice for someone, but in your head, you're like, well, if I do this, then they'll owe me later. Or you might say, well, they did this awesome thing for me, so I want to return the favor. Or there's always a selfish motivation behind no matter what you do. And the reason is because you go in empty. Now, the interesting thing is, and this is really fascinating, couples who are like that, couples who go in empty and being kind of selfish, those are the couples that actually have the greatest amount of passion inside of the relationship. You know why? Couples who go in feeling like, I want to serve you. I want to do everything for you. A couple who goes in like that, you know what happens? You don't feel like you should ever be served. So you feel awkward ever asking for something. Does that make sense? You feel awkward ever saying like, hey, I have a need. Can you help me with it? Because you feel selfish in that moment. And that's why, once again, this is another reason why inside of Christianity, inside the church, so many couples lose passion so fast, is because both people go into the marriage thinking, or into the relationship, whatever it is, thinking, if I want to be Christ-like, I need to always be serving and never allow myself to be served. And you see, all passion vanishes from a relationship when they do that. Okay? All passion vanishes. In fact, you know what replaces the passion? Bitterness. Bitterness. Because the more you serve the other person, the more you feel like they should be serving me back. Why aren't they doing as much as I do for them? I do this and I do that. I clean the house and I do the laundry and I do this and I do that. And what do you do for me? You just sit on your butt. You know, you don't do anything. And like this intense bitterness comes inside of the marriage. Why? Because each person went in not feeling comfortable asking, but only feeling comfortable serving. And so both become bitter. Both become bitter. And the reason why you became bitter is because you sought to do the right thing for the wrong motivation. You sought to do the right thing to be selfless like Jesus, but you didn't understand how he did it in the first place. Right? You didn't understand how to lay aside your garments, to lay aside your pride, and to seek to serve the other person. Let me give you a more specific example. How about in a fight, right? Whether you get into a fight with your best friend, whether you get into a fight with your spouse, whether you get into a fight with your parents, a fight doesn't truly end until somebody humbles themselves, right? If nobody humbles themselves. If both people are just going to be like, no, I was right, you were wrong, that's the end of it, right? If both people say that, then the best that can happen is that fight can go away for a while, right? Like Godzilla, but it's going to come back, right? It's going to come back and it's going to ruin your life again. You know, whatever fight it is, if someone doesn't humble themselves and say, hey, you know what? You were right, I was wrong. If that never happens, the fight will never truly go away. It will just go under the surface for a while, and then it will come back up again stronger than it was before. Now, think about it. This is important. If I go into a relationship selfish, right? If I go into a relationship selfish, when I get into a fight with somebody, which will happen, any love relationship you have will have fights. When you get into a fight with them, if it's all about you, you won't be able to lay aside your garments and say, you know what? Maybe you were right. Maybe I should see things from your perspective. Like I said, some Christian couples try to do this, but they'll do it this way. They'll say, hey, you know what? You're right. I was wrong. And they'll pause. And what are they pausing for? An apology back, right? Hey, I'm sorry. That was kind of my bad. And then the other person's like, yeah, it was your bad. What? You know, it wasn't my bad. You know, you're supposed to say you're sorry too. What happened? You know, like why? Because you're still being selfish. You're still not doing what Jesus did. Now, how is Jesus able to do it? Verse 3, Jesus knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands. How is Jesus able to do it? Jesus was able to do it because he was already filled. He didn't need anything. He literally didn't need anything. When he entered into a love relationship with me, he wasn't looking for anything in return because I can't offer him anything. I can't offer. What am I going to give Jesus? It says the Father gave him all things. What things belong to the Father? The universe, all of time, matter, space, all the angelic hosts, heaven. Do you really think he needs my money? Is he up in heaven like, man, I really hope Peter ties or else I'm screwed. You know, like, man, oh, dude, you know, I really hope that Peter sings me a song today because I'm lonely. You know, like, man, I really hope. Does that make sense? He doesn't need anything from me. I really hope Peter prays to me, man, because I've had a rough day and I really want to hear about his problems. You know, no, Jesus doesn't need anything from you. That's what enabled him to do this. So why can't I do this? I'm not filled. Does that make sense? Because I'm not filled, I can't be selfless in a relationship. I cannot be selfless in a relationship. I will always be selfish. And so because of that, like I said, this is where the great divide happens. That's why I have to choose either passion or loyalty. I can't have both because I'm selfish. Now the Christian solution, what Jesus is saying to us, is the only way for you to love like I love is to love me first so that you could be complete in me. That is the only way you could do it. If you don't do that, you are not going to be able to do this. Let me give an even easier example, right? How many people in this room probably have heard this phrase, he's so needy, right? Or she's so, is that a turn on, by the way? Do when people say that, is that like, man, she's so needy. I love it. You know, she's just like the neediest person ever. What a cutie. You know, like, no, right? That's the biggest turnoff ever when someone's needy, right? When they need something from me. And like I said, if you're in a relationship with someone long enough, you'll realize that they do need something from you, right? Here's another way that might work out inside of a relationship. This is a really common one. And in fact, I counsel a lot of people. I counsel couples, married and unmarried. And what I found inside of my time of counseling is what I realized is that usually the needs are the same, they're just expressed different ways. So the man wants respect, he wants honor, he wants to feel good about himself. And one of the best ways for the man to experience this is actually in sex. Because that's where he feels most in control, most masculine and things like that. That's just where he feels it. And the woman usually desires to feel affirmation, right? I want to know that I'm beautiful. I want to know that I'm loved. I want to know I'm cared for. So what usually happens is the woman will trade sex to receive affirmation. That's just something common that I see all the time. The woman trades intimacy to receive affirmation. I want to feel beautiful. I want to feel loved. I want to feel desired. I want to feel. Does that make sense? So she'll trade one to get the other, and the man will trade sex. So, I mean, he will trade affirmation to receive sex. So in that scenario, both people are what? Selfish. They're both seeking their own. So because of that, neither one will be happy. Now, a relationship can function for a very long time, just so long as each person is filling the other's needs. So as long as me as the man is constantly filling the affirmation need of my wife, the relationship can go great. But the second that my affirmation breaks down, the relationship breaks down. As long as the wife can continue to put out sexually, the husband is happy. But the second that that grinds to a halt, there's trouble in paradise. Does that make sense? As long as both people put out at all times, the relationship could go great. But if you're not solving the root of the problem, and that's your selfishness, it'll always just remain on that status quo. So this is how Jesus solves the problem. He says, what if both people came into the marriage, or both people came into a relationship already full? Neither one needed anything. And what if love didn't seek its own? But instead, your passion, your virility, your joy came from giving, not receiving. Because if you're already full, the only joy, the greatest joy you could receive is in giving. Does that make sense? If you already have everything, what joy is left but to give? If you're already full in Christ, then what joy is there left to do but give? See, if you handle that part of your life, which is impossible, right? We're all seeking it, right? But if you handle that part in your life, you will be able to love perfectly. Everything else falls into place. Okay? But this is our major problem. We can't love perfectly because we don't know what love is. We don't understand what it is to be filled first before we love. Now, the next part, let's talk about this. This is interesting. I love Peter's reaction. So this is verse 6. Then he came to Simon Peter, right? Peter, big math Peter. And Peter said to him, Lord, are you washing my feet? Jesus answered and said to him, what I am doing you do not understand now, but you will know after this. And Peter said to him, you shall never wash my feet, right? He's telling Jesus what to do, right? And this is normally, again, this is a problem that we have in love, okay? Because the next logical question would be like, okay, well, if each person is just always working out of selflessness, then how are you ever going to be able to express your needs or your wants, right? How are you ever going to be able to put it another way, how are you ever going to be able to receive service, right? Because if both people are just seeking to serve one another, then no one's going to get served, right? If I wake up in the morning, I'm like, man, I love my wife so much, I'm going to cook her breakfast. And Emma's like, man, I love my husband so much, I'm going to cook him breakfast. And we both cook breakfast for each other, and we're both like, hey, here's your breakfast. And we're giving each other a breakfast, and I receive it, and I'm like, well, I shouldn't eat that because I want to be selfless. I need to make my own breakfast. But thanks for the thought. You know, I'm like, see, no one gets served. Or to use an even better example, what if like we're thinking about where to go to dinner? Where do you want to go? Well, where do you want to go? Where do you want to go? Where do you want to go? Right? Where each person's trying to serve the other, and because of that, neither person gets served. Now, here's the cool thing about love. This is what Jesus says to him. Jesus answered him, If I do not wash your feet, you have no part of me. This is the coolest thing about love. Think about it this way. Even though Jesus is full, does he receive things from us? He does, right? I don't remember a single time where I was worshiping God where he spoke to me and he's like, stop worshiping me. I should be serving you. Stop it. You know, I don't need it. You know, like, no. He allows me to do it. Why? Who's he thinking about? He's thinking about me. Because he realizes it's better to what? It's better to give than to receive. So this is the crazy thing that love does to us. It realizes something. The greatest joy that someone can have is in giving, right? So if I was looking at someone, let's say it's my wife, and I really wanted to serve her, what would be the best way I could serve her? By letting her serve me. Isn't that weird? That becomes the weirdest part of the love relationship, is both people want to serve each other so much that it keeps going in that direction until one person lays down and he says, you know what? I want you to have the greater joy. I want you to serve me because that's the greatest joy. Does that make sense? So both people are experiencing intense joy at the same time. And that's what breeds that passion. You see, if my passion is subject to how much I serve another person, the mystery, the novelty, all those things, that will never become an issue because what am I always thinking about? I'm always thinking about new ways to what? Serve them. The reason why passion fades the other way is because if you're spending your whole time thinking about, I wonder what new way they're going to serve me, you're always going to be disappointed. But if you spend all your time thinking about, man, I just want to serve them. They're just so awesome. I just want to serve them. I want to love them. And you're just thinking about, the passion will never die. But you can only do that if you're full. Here's another thing that Jesus is illustrating here. He's washing their feet. He's washing their feet. And he lets them know that if you don't let me do this, you have no part of me. And the reason is because, man, if I wash you, you become clean. And this is what he says. This is verse 9. Simon Peter said to him, Lord, not only my hands, but my feet. I mean, not only my feet, but also my hands and my head. So Peter does the classic switch, right? Lord, don't wash my feet. Lord, wash everything. You know, like he goes too far, right? You know, just Jesus is like, hey, I just want to wash your feet. No, don't wash my feet. Okay, I need to wash your feet. Okay, wash everything. No, dude, you're too far. All right, yeah, just your feet. All right, that's all you need is just your feet. And the reason why Peter goes this extreme is because he's ignorant. He doesn't understand what's going on. Right? So when Christians hear this, when they hear that, oh man, it's Jesus' joy to serve me, then they say, oh, okay, well then let's open up the floodgates. All right? If that's his joy, man, like give me a car, give me this, give me that. And then when he doesn't serve you, like, what the heck? What's going on? You know, like Jesus knows what you need and he knows how to differentiate what you want. So when he's serving you, he's always doing the best service. But let's not miss the point of why Jesus did this in the first place. This is verse 10. Jesus said to him, he who is bathed needs only to wash his feet, but is completely clean. And you are clean, but not all of you. Now here's the problem with human love, right? Affirmation can only go so far. If I feel like junk, if I feel like I'm a terrible person, and I feel shame-ridden, and I feel terrible, and I feel ugly, it doesn't really matter how much affirmation you give me, because my voice is always going to scream louder than yours. Does that make sense? If I feel ugly, no amount of someone saying, you're beautiful, you're awesome, you're amazing, you're incredible, is ever going to make those feelings go away. You still feel ugly. A great way to think about that, I watch Duck Dynasty with Emma sometimes. And, you know, like, Phil is the dad of Duck Dynasty, and Kay is the mom. And one time she walks out in a dress, and she's like, how do I look? And he's like, you look great, honey. And she's like, no, I don't. You know, like, and he's just like, no, you really do. And she's like, no, I don't. She just can't believe him. Because as she's looking at herself in the mirror, she's saying, I look ugly. And it doesn't matter what you say, I will always look ugly. Right? Affirmation can't wash away problems. It can't wash away faults. Okay, if I sin against someone, if I really sin against someone I love deeply, it's going to cut me worse than anything else. Right? If I love someone, I sin against them, it's going to cut me worse than anything else that's going to happen inside of my life. And here's the thing. No amount of them saying, I forgive you, I love you, I care for you, is ever going to erase the guilt and the shame that's inside of my heart. Here's why Jesus' love is superior. Jesus, first of all, he loves us the way we are. He loves us the way we are. Now, in all of our like fairy tale definitions of love, that's always how we think of it, right? I just watched the movie Cinderella. And there's that scene, I love the scene, you know, where she comes into the ball, right? And she walks down the staircase. And the prince, who's surrounded by all these gorgeous princesses with these huge amounts of land and dowries and all this stuff, and he stops everything and he just looks straight at her and he ignores everyone else in the room. And the picture there is like where everyone else saw Cinderella as just like a worthless servant girl, here's this one man who sees her and just is floored by her beauty. He is so attracted to her that no one else even comes into his brain. You know, even though she's poor, even though she has her faults, he sees past all of them and he just loves her. Right? And we'd like to think that that's what love does, right? But here's what the truth is. When someone loves you, when someone falls in love with you, and like I said, that passion is there, what ends up happening is we idealize people. Here's what I mean by that. Once I get into a relationship with someone and I fall in love with them, the passion and the intimacy allows me to elevate her good qualities and ignore her bad qualities. And that's why usually when I sit in and I talk to people who have been married for 10 or 15 years and they're having marital problems, usually what they'll say is, I don't know how I didn't see it before. but she's really freaking irritating. You know, like they just, they're like, I didn't notice it for 10 years. I don't understand how I didn't notice it. You want to know why you didn't notice it? You didn't want to notice it. You see, you didn't love her faults. You weren't able to actually care about her faults. Your love for her was just strong enough to blind you to her faults. And that's not the same thing. Those faults still bug you. You just didn't admit it in the moment. Does that make sense? See, here's why Jesus is superior. Jesus loves me in my faults, but his love is actually strong enough to lift me out of them. He could actually cleanse me from them. When he says you're beautiful, it's different than when anyone else says you're awesome, you're amazing, I love you. It's different than anyone else because when Jesus says it, it means that he actually did something to make me that way. He doesn't just say, hey, I love you. He makes you exactly what he wants you to be. He makes you into something beautiful. He washes away all the dirt, all the grime, all the sin, all the guilt, all the shame. He washes it. He makes you clean. No other love is strong enough to do that. No other love is strong enough to do that. And that's why it's so gorgeous for us when we read it in this way. Now, another thing that's important about this is, let's go to verse 11. So in verse 10, he says, he who is bathed needs only to wash his feet and is completely clean, but you are clean, but not all of you, for he knew who would betray him. Therefore, he said, you are not all clean. Get this. Judas Iscariot, the guy who's about to betray Jesus in just like 3 hours, Jesus washed his feet. Isn't that radical? Now, put yourself in Jesus' shoes. You're in a room with people, and you know, in 3 hours, 10 of them are going to run away from me. One of them is going to deny me 3 times. And one of them is going to actually be an instrument in my death. Do you think the next thing that would come into your brain is, I really want to wash their feet? That sounds like something I really want to do. I really just want to wash them because they're just so awesome. You wouldn't do that, right? Especially when you got to Judas's feet. You can just imagine Jesus getting to Judas's feet like, no, you know, you wash your own feet, you jerk, you're going to betray me, you know, get out of here, you know, he just throws them out. You know, that's what we would expect, that's what we would think in our own minds. Jesus washes this guy's feet. See, what if there was a love that can hope all things in all situations? This is the love of God. The love of God is so strong, it's so powerful that he is able to passionately, intimately, and wonderfully love even his enemies. Now, this is something that is totally foreign to us, right? I could love people who love me back, but to love someone who blatantly hates me is impossible. I can't do that. I just cannot do that. When someone hates me, I hate them back. And when I hate someone, here's the weird thing about me. I don't know if any of you guys could relate to this. When I hate someone, I try to get them to hate me back, which is the weird thing. You know, I feel kind of uncomfortable when someone loves me and I hate them. Like, man, I hate you. I love you. You know, it just makes me angry. You should hate me. You know, and I try to do things to make them hate me. Because it feels justified in a way if someone hates me back. You know what I mean? I don't know. Maybe I'm alone on that. But anyway, Jesus is totally opposite, where he is able to intimately love people who hate him and want to kill him. And once again, how is he able to do that? Because he's already full. He's already full, and his joy comes in serving, even serving those who hate him. Once again, another thing to bring out in this scenario is the fact that, once again, Jesus is about to die. He's about to die. How many people, if you knew you were about to die, if I said, hey, you have a week left to live, what would you do? How many of you would be like, I just want to serve people for my last week. And on the last night, I just want to wash people's feet, and I just want to tell them how great, you know, God is. I'll always be like, well, I want to see the Grand Canyon. I want to go to Disney World. I want to, you know, make a wish foundation. I want Michael Jordan to come and dunk over my head. You know, I want this. You know, you have all these things that you want people to do for you. Why? Because you're about to die, right? You're like, dude, this is my last day on earth. You know, I don't want to waste it serving others. That's lame. Jesus is able to do that, though. And it's been amazing to me inside of my time in ministry to see people who love God die. And what I mean by that is when I see people, there are some saints in my life that I've seen who genuinely love God, that when they died, they literally did spend their last moments serving others. Lisa Furrow, who is the wife of Robert Furrow, she had lung cancer, and literally the last week of her life, she was sending out emails and tweets to people saying, like, God loves you, God cares for you, you know, I'm praying for you. And you read those things, you're like, how could you do that? Shouldn't you be emailing people, pray for me, you know, I'm about to die, you know, like those things. But she's just like, man, I just love you. She's serving people till the day she died. Why? Because she had tasted the love of God and she realized, I don't need anything beyond that. My joy is in service. Imagine having a relationship with someone where they had that kind of attitude. Right? Now, forget dying. When I have a bad day, I can't love people. Right? You know, if I'm driving home and someone cuts me off in traffic, the last thing I'm thinking about, man, I just want to serve people. I'm like, oh, you know, I'm so angry. You know, like my day is going so bad. You know, I can't serve anybody. You know, and what do? I do the whole passive aggressive thing. Hey, how was your day? Oh, it was bad. You know, like it was a bad day. You know, like what am I looking for when I say things like that? I'm looking for what? Well, I love you. You know, you're awesome. You know, I'm fishing. Why? Because I had a bad day. Now, if I can't even love people while I'm having a bad day, how am I going to love people when I'm dying? You know, like it's just impossible. The only way you can find strength to do that is if you really genuinely are over the moon in love with God. And you just are tasting His love every day and you're becoming more and more passionate about that love every single day. That is the only way you're going to be able to love like that. That's the only way that you're ever going to be able to love your enemies. It's the only way you're going to be able to give up your prestige and your honor and your pride and serve somebody else and humble yourself and say that you were wrong and esteem others higher than yourself. It's the only way you're going to be able to do any of that. Now, the final reason I'm going to give, I don't have time to go through all of this, unfortunately. We're going to skip all the way ahead. We're going to be in verse 36. Simon Peter said to him, Lord, where are you going? Jesus answered him, where I am going, you cannot follow me now, but you shall follow me afterward. The final problem with love that we have on the human level is love always ends. That's the thing we don't like to think about, right? No matter how deep or intimate or passionate a relationship is, it will end. Either you're going to die and you're going to leave the other person, or they're going to die and they're going to leave you. But that relationship, that love, will end. There's only one love that's stronger than the grave. There's only one love that actually died so that we could be with Him forever, and that is the love of God. See? Jesus says, you can't follow me yet, but you will follow me afterward. You will be with me forever. Only Jesus offers us a love that will never end, a love without fading, a love without equal. And once again, if you understand this type of love, you understand this type of forgiveness that God has for you, it's amazing. Let me just read these last couple of verses because they're just incredible to me. Verse 37. Peter said to him, Lord, why can I not follow you? I will lay down my life for your sake. Jesus answered him, will you lay down your life for my sake? Most assuredly, I say to you, the rooster shall not crow till you have denied me three times. This is the most amazing and incredible and awesome thing about Jesus' love. One of the things that we fear most, for me anyway, in love relationships, is I really fear letting people down that I care about. I really feel I'm not doing my best for them, sinning against them, failing against them. And that's one of the greatest fears that I have inside of my life, because I realize what a mess I am and how I usually do wreck people's lives. And when you feel that way, you almost kind of want to protect the world from yourself. You're just like, dude, you know what? I think I'm just going to ruin your life by loving you. I think the best thing I could do is get away from you. This is the best way I could love you. This is the most amazing thing about God. You can never disappoint God. Did you know that? When Jesus said this, you can't disappoint Jesus because He already knows what you're going to do. Disappointing someone means that you didn't live up to an expectation that they had for you. Right? That's what disappointing means. You can't disappoint God because He already knows what you're going to do. When I sin, it's not like God's up in heaven like, you know, I didn't know, you know, like, oh man, I don't know what to do now, you know, Peter blew it, you know, it's over, you know, my plan's ruined, you know. That's not how God is. You know, He definitely didn't look at Peter like, I can't believe you betrayed me three times, you know, it's insane, you know, I never saw it coming, you know. God already knows what you're going to do, so you can never disappoint Him. And that's an awesome thing to know when you come and you repent before God, to know for a certainty that He's not disappointed in you. But He already knew what you were going to do, and He already forgave you in advance. That's what Jesus is saying to Peter. He's saying, dude, I already know you're going to deny me three times. But I'm still going to wash your feet. I'm still going to love you, and I'm still going to receive you back to me. That's a love that's insane to me. And here's how I'm going to end this. Let me put it this way. This love that we have, not only for God, but for other people, because Jesus does call us to love people like he loves us. And he actually says in that chapter, he says, by this people will know that you belong to me. Now that's a convicting statement in and of itself, right? How many of you guys were like, man, you know how I knew that God was in the church? The love that they had. The love that they had for one another. That would be beautiful. That was the testimony. But unfortunately, usually people are like, you know, the reason why I left the church is because I didn't feel any love. There was none there. See, like I said, that was one of the reasons why I left the church. I didn't see passionate love happening in the church. I saw a bunch of fakeness and hypocrisy. So I didn't trust that there was a love like this. See, God calls us to love like this. But the only way to do this, the only way, if you want to have the capacity to love people passionately, intimately, loyally, habitually, right, to have the fulfillment of joy inside of your life, you must seek passion in God. God does want your loyalty, yes, but he wants a passionate relationship with you. You must seek passion with Jesus. And the only way to do it, and this is the coolest part about God, the only way to do it is to ask. You cannot produce passion, right? But there's another way to look at it too. Not only can you not produce passion, but you can't just expect it to happen, right? You could fall into one or two traps. You could fall into the trap that says, well, you know, loving God is just a passionless thing. You know, I should just go about it and just, you know, just serve him no matter what. It's not about emotion. It's about choice. And I'm just going to serve God. And this is my life. That's going to be lame. You're going to hate it. But the other trap that you could fall into is just like, well, I just, you know, I know that passion will come. So I just trust God. He's going to give me passion. And you just go about your life and you, I don't know what you think, because I've thought this way before. I honestly don't know what I'm thinking. Like, I'm going to be sitting down tomorrow playing video games and all of a sudden, you know, it's going to hit my heart. Like, oh my gosh, I love God so much. You know, and I'm going to go out and start sharing my faith. You know, it doesn't happen that way. If you want passion for God, you must seek him and you must ask for that passion. If you want to feel passion like you've never felt before, if you want to feel love that you've never felt before, you must seek it. Jesus says, ask, seek, knock. For those who ask, it will be answered. Those who seek will find. Those who knock, it will be open to you. If you want it, you must pursue it passionately. You must seek God. And that means you must seek God in the little things. Now, you must seek God in the little things. It's like any other relationship. If you want a passionate relationship, you got to do the little things with that person. You got to seek him in his word. You got to seek him in prayer. You got to seek him in worship. You got to be doing daily things, pursuing him passionately. And once again, daily asking for that passion as you do these things. And I'll tell you, in my life, the love of God has been the most incredible, wonderful, beautiful, amazing, passionate thing I've ever felt. It is incredible. Yes, there is a logic to it. Yes, I believe in God because of the things that I've seen and because of the foundation of faith that I have. That's all true. But the passion I have for Jesus is incredible. And he gives it to me. It's nothing you can produce. It's nothing I produce. It's something that he gives me freely. And it's incredible. It feels amazing. And I hope for you guys that you do it as well. Another way to look at it, and one last thing I'm going to say, not only do you have to pursue him, ask for it, you have to see him as being beautiful. When you're reading the Bible, those are the couple things that I want you, that should always be going through your brain. I want to see the beauty of God, and I want to relate to him. If you go in the Bible and you say, I want God to speak to me, whatever that means, and you're expecting some revelation every single time, you're going to always walk away from the Bible feeling cruddy. If you go into the Bible saying, Jesus, I want to see your beauty, I want to see how awesome you are, and I want to get closer to you, you'll always leave the Bible feeling full. Right? Let's pray. Dear God, I do thank you so much for your love, how amazing it is and how passionate it is, Lord. Please help us to understand that this love, it's not a fairy tale, God. It's real. Help us to abide in it. Help us to trust in it. Help us to love in it and help us to grow in it. God, you are everything. Help us to see that. And in your name, amen.